Sunstone Theological Society presents Shaking Off the Curse, Welcoming Blacks into Mormonism. Recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
You are in session number 19, called Shaking Off the Curse, Welcoming Blacks into Mormonism. We're going to hear from four different speakers, and then hopefully at the end we will have a moment or two for your questions or comments. We will first hear from Hattie Soil. Hattie was born in Mississippi. She was raised in Memphis, Tennessee. She moved to Chicago in 1963, where she currently resides. Hattie was baptized in the church 6 years ago. She's had a variety of callings within the church, including young women's presidencies, primary presidencies. She is currently involved in the literacy program. Her professional credentials are listed in your program. They include working for the City College of Chicago. Sort of making sure, she says, that there's a certain amount of racial balance. After we hear from Hattie, we will hear from Sue Haas, who is at the far end. Sue was raised in San Francisco, and she has lived in New Orleans for the past 25 years. Her qualifications for speaking on a panel regarding blacks in the church are probably, or perhaps not as obvious as Hattie's. So I'd like to tell you that her husband has taught at Dillard University. He's taught at black universities in the South for the past 25 years. They have lived in black community. She has been deeply committed to racial issues for the vast majority of her life. She is the grandmother of an adopted black child, and she has very deep and qualifying feelings that she would like to share with you. After we hear from Sue, we will hear from Sonia Farnsworth. Her qualifications are also not quite as obvious as the Soils. Sonia is the mother of an adopted black child who is deeply concerned about racial issues within the church, as it reflects the church generally, and obviously more especially in the life of her child personally. She is, again, deeply committed to the issue of racism within the church, and she's wonderful. I can't help but say that. After we hear from Sonia, we will conclude the panel remarks with comments from Victor Soil, who is Hattie's husband, obviously. Victor was born and raised in Chicago, baptized, I believe, with Hattie at the same time, June of 1982. He has served in Elders Quorum presidencies. He has served in bishoprics, I believe he told me, for about 3.5 years or so. He is currently in the Young Men's Presidency. Young Men's President. He works with the Chicago Board of Education as a truant officer. He works in an area of Chicago that is all black, consists of mostly single-parent families, where the annual income is about $5,000 a year. So he is very aware of racial problems, I believe he'll have some very worthwhile things to say. After we hear from these four speakers, we will open it to comments and questions from you. I would like to also note that your program does list another speaker, Louise Ardalan, who has been, for personal reasons, unable to attend. So to avoid confusion, I thought I'd mention that. We'll turn the time over now to Hattie.
All of my life, I've been hindered by things that I could not do because of my skin color. There have been times when I've been rejected by my own race because I was too dark to be in or up front in many activities. I have also been rejected by whites because they have been taught that blacks were not as intelligent and hardworking as they were. In the South, where I was raised, I encountered many aspects of segregation, such as separation of races by railroad tracks, school segregation, color sitting in the back of the bus, and drinking water fountain for colors only. So my relationship with the white race was limited. Society made sure of that. I had more or less positive experiences when I was introduced to the church in 1982. I was accepted by most members of the ward from the time I was an investigator and the time I was investigating the church until I joined. Black people were something new that was added to the ward, and most of the university students were trying to be very liberal. They wanted to put into practice some of the things that they had learned about interacting with black people. And this was great. But I was not naive. I knew some white members were not particularly happy with my presence, and those members were the ones that made me feel uncomfortable when I was around them. I never had a problem with this. I ignored them and their attitudes toward black people, especially since I was accepted by the majority. I've had Sundays that I had to come home and pray because someone would make an insensitive statement about black people, such as, and I quote, "Our black skin is the result of evil activities." Well, few people have skin as dark as mine, and I don't consider myself particularly evil. When we welcome people into the church who are different than we are, we must be careful about what we say, because many black people have left the church in anger and as a result of insensitivity. Since the gospel is universal, I feel that everyone should be welcomed with love and understanding, tolerance and respect, not with condescension or a smug sense of moral superiority. Thank you.
What I'd like to talk about, I'd like to talk about ensuring that there'll be homegirls in the celestial kingdom. And down south, a homegirl is a real treasure. It's someone that grew up in your own hometown, that understands you, and when you're away at school or in the big city and you find a homegirl, there's this instant rapport that's generated. And so what I feel is, if I ever make it to the celestial kingdom, I'd like there to be homegirls from my ward up there welcoming me. But that won't happen unless we change our attitudes and we reach out our hand and help. One black woman that's sure to be there in the welcoming committee is a sister named Frida Bullia. She was born in the early 1900s in a little tiny town in Mississippi called Tylertown. And she never really understood how the missionaries came and converted her family, because they weren't supposed to talk to blacks. But they converted her entire family. They were all baptized when Frida was 8. Then they weren't welcome in any of the little branches in southern Mississippi, but the missionaries would come once a year and spend a week with them and refresh their faith. And then Frida moved to New Orleans, got married, and her only choice was to marry a non-member. There were no other black LDS. She could never have children, but she raised several nieces and nephews that were active in the church. Frida was an excellent seamstress. She embroidered hundreds of pillowcases for Relief Society bazaars. She paid a full tithing, even though her husband was a non-member. She and I were visiting teaching companions for several years, so I really got to know her well. And she knew how the welfare system worked, but she didn't believe in it too much. And her husband worked as a stockman in a grocery store and was a jazz drummer, so they had very little money. But Frida always had money in her purse for the people that needed it worse than she did when we'd go visiting teaching. So this inspired me to keep a few shekels in my purse, because there were some people that were very poor that we were visiting. And another person that's sure to be in the welcoming committee at the Celestial Kingdom is Frieda's brother. I never met him, but during the Second World War, he was a mess boy on a troop ship in the North Atlantic, and a white shipmate fell overboard, and he got a life preserver and jumped in, and they were able to pull the white man out, and the black man died singing, "Oh, My Father." And I found this out when I noticed that Frieda cried every time we sang, "Oh, My Father," and now I do, because that a man that could not hold the priesthood would have enough faith to give his life for someone else and then die singing that hymn has always been an inspiration to me. Well, many of the ideas I have for welcoming blacks into the church come from asking my black friends in the ward. And the first thing that they said would be the first thing that if you ask President Benson or you ask any bishop, it's called fellowshipping. But I think blacks need more fellowshipping than whites, or need more aware fellowshipping, because most blacks, like Hattie said, have felt blatant or subtle prejudice all their life. And so they tend to interpret things and expect prejudice. And so when somebody doesn't say hello to them, they could interpret this as prejudice, when it's really the primary president thinking about 14 things rushing by, not being aware. So it takes great awareness on our part. And I think each of us needs to welcome new black members into the ward. We need to welcome all members. And many of these things I say are true about everybody. But especially we need to welcome the black members. And then we all don't like everyone, but I think each of us will find one or two people that we become friends with. Because a black convert needs friends. They need somebody to ensure and assure them that they've done the right thing. Converts' families will be giving them a hard time about joining the white folks' church, joining a church where they were second-class citizens. I mean, put yourself in their place. Would you stay in a church where you were the only white face, where 98% of the people didn't even talk to you, where you had trouble understanding what people were saying, where the music was different, it was loud, and people kept clapping, where one man gave a sermon on Sunday, and everybody interrupted it with amen, and praise God, where in the cultural hall they sold beer and everybody smoked? This would be totally foreign to your experience, and you wouldn't be comfortable. This is what black people feel when they come into our church. It is totally different from where they've been much of the time. And so we need to welcome them. We need to help the transition. And I found that the investigators class is an important part of this. They need to really be welcomed into the investigators class and study it. And then when they graduate, they need to feel welcome in the gospel doctrine class, that they need to realize that here too they're welcome. And several of the people I talked to said that they were very familiar with the Bible, but the Book of Mormon seemed strange and foreign to them. It was so different than their scriptures. And others, we've had people that could barely read come in. So for a while, we had a Book of Mormon study group. And it took a lot of time. But I think it really helped the new members grow, and it helped us all grow closer to the new members. And when we were done, we had a much closer bond between about the 6 or 8 people that came for the 6 months that it lasted. And blacks want to be useful, functional members of the church. And it's important to offer them callings right away, important to ask them to do things. Remember that they too can bring food to the Relief Society dinner, ask them to read scriptures. Just anything that you would do for anyone else, the skin color doesn't need to matter. You need to just welcome them in, and this is something each of us can do. And I know in our ward, we expect everyone remembers that, you know, the fourth Thursday is Relief Society homemaking. Well, everybody doesn't remember. New members need to be called and reminded and then given a ride. And speaking of rides, that's a big problem in the New Orleans ward. The two-car family is an American middle-class phenomenon for whites. The no-car family is the norm in most southern urban blacks. That you can get around town real good during weekdays, but on weekends, the bus system grinds to a halt, and Mormon churches are way off in the boondocks. It takes me 12 minutes to drive to church and an hour and a half to get there on the bus. And so that's a real problem. So we've sort of a ride-sharing system in our ward. But the problem is that we have large families and small cars. And so it's really hard to find room for several, a black family consisting of five people. This is difficult. I think what we may have to do is take a cue from many of the black churches. The Black Baptist Church near us has a van, goes around and picks up all the people that don't have cars. And that, it presents insurance problems, it presents logistics problems, but it may be an answer that has to be used. And then if you think getting people to church is a problem, think of early morning seminary. The buses don't even run in New Orleans at 4:30 in the morning. And we have two young black priesthood holders that live 2 hours from church on the bus. And so a very wise elders quorum president made it a calling for the brethren to pick these young men up. And when you think of elders quorum and service, I tend to think of painting people's houses, helping people move. Well, the kingdom's being far better furthered by taking these two young men to seminary. And so I think elders quorums may need to revise their priorities as the church changes color, as the color improves in our wards. Another important thing that a good black sister pointed out was that if the bishop assigned home teachers and visiting teachers before a person was baptized, then these people could be at the baptism. They could welcome the new member into the ward, and there'd be four instant friends there. And then the new convert should get called as a home teacher or a visiting teacher immediately. They should get a calling immediately. And two of the sisters said, don't put us in primary. We never will meet anyone. No one will know we're there. And I think that's important for all converts, to staff primary with the old guard. Black members need to be encouraged to share their experiences. Perhaps black support groups could be organized on a stake level. And I came out here expecting to get a subscription to Ebony Rose to take home to our library and discovered last night that it may not exist anymore. But I think it's an important thing. I know as a Mormon feminist, I feel support groups are important. And I'm sure if I were an LDS black, I would feel support groups are important. Another thing, we need to be careful how we answer questions about the difficult things, why blacks couldn't hold the priesthood, about polygamy. We need to give honest answers. We don't need, as we say in Louisiana, you don't need to crawfish and just avoid the issue. And I guess I hadn't thought of the answer that the people that spoke last night were given, that they were sons of Cain, because I would tend to give the answer that occurred in the last statement of the first presidency, which was basically, it beats the heck out of me. And I think that would be the answer that they need to get, which is the truth. And then education, I think, is always important. And what started my interest in this talk was a year ago in July, they asked me to give a talk for Pioneer's Day. And I always hated Pioneer's Day talks. That was the worst. And so I decided to talk about black pioneers, because I figured that if I were black sitting in the audience, that's what I'd want to hear about, is some of my soul brothers and sisters and what they'd done. And so I talked about Elijah Abel, who received the priesthood, who was an elder and a 70, who served on a mission to Canada, who served a stake mission when he was in Cincinnati, who then went to Salt Lake and discovered that he didn't have all the privileges he'd had. He'd done baptisms for the dead in Nauvoo, and he couldn't go into the temple in Salt Lake. He worked on it, but he couldn't go in it. And yet this man went on a mission at 73, served a year, came home, and died within 2 weeks of when he got home. And that's a true example of faith and persistence. And black members need to know that. They need role models. They need to know that there are faithful black brothers and sisters. I told about Mary Sterlaugesson Iyer, whose first greeting to the missionaries was in her best street language, that I'm sure these Utah boys had never heard. And she went from this, she hated God, Joseph Smith, and Jesus, they were all honkies. And she graduated from this to seeing the love in the missionary's face. as they taught the gospel. Her family disowned her for joining the church, and this is a common problem. And then she petitioned for 2 years to be called on a mission, and finally after 1978 she was, and she was sure she'd be sent to Africa, and yet she ended up in San Antonio, which is south, not just Texas. San Antonio is a bad place for blacks, or used to be. And so I felt that by telling ward members, both the black and the white members, about this, they would learn that there are these are universal experiences, and that's something we can all grow from. And then, have you ever read a paragraph that just crystallizes your thinking? Levina Anderson wrote one. It said, "I like to hear children sing, 'I am a child of God.' I don't like to hear adults sing it. I'm sorry it's in the new hymnal. Everybody's a child of God. All you have to do to be a child of God is be born. Big deal. The hard part is to become an adult of God. Most of us get stuck being an adolescent of God." Well, I'd always been bothered by people singing, adults especially, singing, "I am a child of God." And this sort of clarified my concerns. I know Christ wants us to stay childlike in many ways. Trust, teachability, faith, and humility. But just as a child grows, we've got to grow spiritually. And some of the traits we must develop are those shown by the black pioneers. A child is short on persistence. Their attention is measured in nanoseconds. But to be a successful adult of God, we need to manifest persistence and love, like Elijah Abel did, like Mary Iyer did. And there are lots of similarities between black and white LDS. We're all children of God on our way to becoming adults. We have the same need to love and help others. And Mormon Standard Time is awful similar to colored folks' time, I've discovered. On the other hand, black English in New Orleans is very different than the King's English. And we've got to remember that the same testimonies and thoughts can be expressed in both, and that neither one is near the pure Adamic language. So we shouldn't feel too self-righteous. Prayer in black churches is a different experience than in white churches. And nothing's wrong with a few amens in the middle of prayer. Perhaps this will enliven our services. Preaching in a black Baptist church is a far cry from sacrament meeting. But as the converts talk to us in that style, I think it increases our appreciation. We need to be open to change. As several of the sisters said, Mormon music is flat boring. And we need to be ready to open ourselves to the richness of spirituals. And I don't know about your ward, but irreverence in our ward at the beginning is a terrible problem. And I've attended an African Methodist Episcopal church in Boston where they have singspiration. The music minister gets up 10 minutes before church starts, and they start singing something like Onward Christian Soldiers and rousing hymns, and then they slowly tone down into very reverent hymns. And it's really a special experience to walk in the middle of that. Perhaps that would help. Soul food certainly would make our Relief Society dinners and lunches tastier. And so we've got to realize that what our black brothers and sisters bring us will enrich us if we're open-minded enough to let it. But we all are going to need constant reminding by talks, lessons, and actions so we can appreciate this diversity. When our black brothers and sisters arrive in the ward, they have faith in the gospel. But there's got to be more than the gospel they find when they get there. They need to find adults of God that will welcome them with open arms and hearts and help them through their adolescence. Then as they mature, they can reach back and help the new crop of teenagers, both black and white. They can become the strong role models that new black members need. And as this rainbow of adults of God becomes even more multi-hued, the kingdom will continue to grow. And then if we make the celestial kingdom, the homegirls will be there cooking a dinner of soul food for us. Thank you.
In July of 1979, I received a tiny black female infant from Brother Olison at LDS Social Services. I named her Haley after Alex Haley, the author of Roots. However, so many people warned me not to emphasize her African heritage that after a few days, I changed the spelling from H-A-L-E-Y to H-A-Y-L-E-Y and began telling everyone that I was naming her after Haley Mills, the actress. For days I did nothing but hold her, reflecting on this rejection of her blackness and pondering about my first glimpse of the devaluation she would face in our white society. Although kindness and love were shown her in our ward, by the time her adoption was complete, Haley and I had survived several incidents of blatant prejudice. Wanting to know my new enemy, I studied the history and process of racism in the United States. As a Mormon, I became fascinated with the black priesthood issue and left sinkfuls of dishes undone in an effort to read and understand what had happened. The complex story that emerged did not destroy my faith in Mormonism, but it did change many of my assumptions about the infallibility of prophets, how doctrine is developed, and how history and culture influence our true church. I am deeply grateful for the Mormon belief in direct revelation. Without it, the dilemma of blacks and the priesthood might still exist. A final word from God would seem a marvelous solution to any problem. However, 10 years after the revelation, I find its marvelousness somewhat limited. Complex problems still exist and give me much concern. President Kimball's announcement of the 1978 revelation on priesthood was a model of goodwill and diplomacy. Although the denial of priesthood to blacks had long been an embarrassment to the church, nothing of the difficulties that the ban had created for Latter-day Saints was touched upon in its very tactful language. It appeared that the church was merely explaining what had always been imperturbably understood. In this manner, years after the loudest outcries against priesthood restrictions had ceased, President Kimball attempted to preserve Mormon dignity before the world. However, in spite of a revelation from God, many things remained unclear. The statement included no explanation of what had been the reason for past priesthood restrictions and, thankfully, endorsed none of the popular theories on the subject. Those from whom the priesthood had been withheld were commended for their faithfulness, while church leaders were portrayed as beseeching and prayerful. Such was the delicacy with which the facts were dispensed. To date, only the late Apostle Bruce R. McConkie has offered a deeper understanding. His talk, "All Are Alike Unto God," was given to seminary and institute personnel a few months after the revelation and now appears in a supplementary handbook for church educators. It is thus an acknowledged authoritative statement on the subject. We are fortunate to have a powerfully descriptive record of his experience and participation in this sacred event. As I read it, I noted that he was able to reconcile the disagreeable fact that although past LDS leaders had stated blacks would not receive the priesthood in mortality, their words had been proven untrue by the recent revelation. While admitting that these men had spoken with a limited understanding, Brother McConkie found ways to express the reassurance that things had gone according to God's plan nevertheless. Church credibility remained intact. It was clearly a skillful effort at religious diplomacy, and only upon closer examination did I perceive the pattern of a serious oversight. In each case, rescue of the church's reputation had been performed at the expense of the black image. In short, the church was left smelling like a rose, while blacks were left holding the bag, still blamed for a cursed lineage and a cowardly preexistence. Probably unaware of historical research that disputes these negative theories about blacks, the church has sanctioned only Brother McConkie's position. Unsanctioned, of course, are the works of Armand Mose, Lester Bush, and Newell Bringhurst, Mormon scholars who hold no powerful ecclesiastical positions, but whose skilled research demonstrates how blacks were denied the priesthood because of an understandable but undeniable misconception, and who show there is little evidence to support the theories of curses and preexistent neutrality. If this is unfortunate, it is also unfair. It is certainly cause for concern to blacks who are saddled with an undercurrent of negative imagery which is still being promulgated by the church education system. As these unflattering views persist, blacks are unable to oppose their official status without seeming contrary. Church efforts to contradict racist attitudes within the membership, such as the recent First Presidency statement on racial equality, have focused upon civil rights, still leaving the past unclear and blacks with little recourse against it. To support the evidently honestly held belief that the church had been without fault in denying blacks the priesthood, official explanations built upon the premise that blacks had been properly denied it. Thus, our theology still contains a racism that the 1978 revelation and subsequent First Presidency statements were missed. With other perspectives available from fine Mormon scholars, I wish to identify and challenge the arguments outlined in the supplementary handbook, which leave blacks censured for what was, in fact, the church's misunderstanding. To begin with, the 1978 revelation is officially described as a matter of faith and seeking on the one hand, and a matter of the divine timetable on the other. Though the faith and seeking part of this scenario seem undeniable, evidence for a divine timetable is harder to justify. It rests upon the assumption that blacks were correctly denied the priesthood prior to June of 1978. And because this assumption is not generally questioned by Latter-day Saints, the argument for a heavenly agenda appears to be adequate. After all, for a restriction to be lifted, it must first exist. What seems unknown to most Mormons, general authorities included, is the probability that this is not the case and that, in fact, the priesthood ban had been based on false evidence. According to Lester Bush in his article, Mormonism's Negro Doctrine, there was, quote, "there was no contemporary evidence that the prophet limited priesthood eligibility because of race or biblical lineage. On the contrary, the only definite information presently available reveals that he allowed a black to be ordained an elder and later a 70 in the Melchizedek priesthood," unquote. Bush's examination of council minutes on the subject from 1879 to 1908 was telling. It indicated that a pattern of hearsay unwittingly perpetuated among the brethren had gradually developed into the strong impression that Joseph Smith had initiated the restriction. Thirdly, although the Pearl of Great Price Curse of Cain proof texts are considered evidence that such restrictions are appropriate, closer looks reveal that they hold up only upon the assumption that a unique continuous lineage extends from Cain and Ham to the present and that this is the lineage of the contemporary Negro. Fourthly, the earliest statement of priesthood denial based on the theory of preexistent neutrality is clearly speculation. Other arguments exist to dispute a valid black priesthood denial, but these 4 points are sufficient as examples of what scholars have observed. Apart from this, statements in both the Book of Mormon and the New Testament can be cited to create more than a reasonable doubt that it was ever proper to deny blacks the priesthood. In short, there is much to show the whole idea was a misunderstanding, and thus the Lord's timetable excuse, which implies the exact coincidence of a prophet's prayer and God's readiness to end the restriction, seems extremely convenient. It is persuasive because it justifies the discrepancies, requires no careful knowledge of the evidence, and takes advantage of commonly held assumptions. It also appeals to our need for spiritual security by picturing the church within the will of God. However, when seen against a background of the facts, it becomes nothing more than a non sequitur. While it flourishes, blacks will continue to be viewed as a people freshly emancipated from a well-deserved restriction, rather than a race falsely accused of a cursed lineage. In this way, they remain the scapegoats whose backs bear the weight of LDS credibility. Further attempts to reconcile inconsistencies in regards to black priesthood suggest that the denial was not an unusual incident in the history of God's dealings with the world. Quote, "The gospel goes to various peoples and nations on a priority basis. Our revelations talk about its going to every creature. There was, of course, no possible way for us to do all of this in the beginning, nor can we now in the full sense. And so, guided by inspiration, we begin to go from one nation and one culture to another. Someday, in the providences of the Lord, we shall get into Red China and Russia," unquote. In this way, the church's priesthood ban is described as part of an inspired pattern of denial by priority. Russia and Red China are cited as parallel cases. However, the gospel is unavailable to these nations for geopolitical reasons, not those of race. When people of those same ethnic backgrounds are found in the free world, they are welcomed into the full blessings of the gospel. In other words, prior to 1978, no blacks could receive the full gospel, while Chinese refugees could. To compare their situation to that of blacks is to trivialize the exceptional and derogatory nature of the ban by making it seem ordinary. After all, no specific crimes or curses are ascribed to the Russians or the Chinese. Thus, the effect of making this comparison leaves an accusing finger pointed directly at blacks. They must be tolerant indeed to forgive the weighing of an insulting accusation of cursed lineage on the same scale as mere geopolitical inconvenience. The following statement by Brother McConkie reflects the awesome credibility dilemma in which the church found itself at the time of the revelation. Quote, "There are statements in our literature by the early brethren which we have interpreted to mean that the Negroes would not receive the priesthood in mortality. I have said the same things, and people write me letters and say, 'You said such and such, and how is it that now we do such and such?' Forget everything that I have said, or that Brigham Young or George Buchanan or whomever has said in days past that is contrary to the present revelation. We spoke with a limited understanding. One underlying reason for what happened to us is that the brethren asked in faith, and the other underlying principle is that in the eternal providences of the Lord, the time had come for the extending of the gospel to a race and culture to whom it had previously been denied, unquote. These words demonstrate my previous point concerning the Lord's timetable excuse and show Brother McConkie's belief that past priesthood denial was justified. However, although it is an unprecedented admission of error by church leaders, there are some clear limitations imposed upon this confession. For only those things contrary to the present revelation are to be dismissed. Curses and pre-existent neutrality are not specifically denied. Tying all this together is the perplexing idea that even in blatant error, the church manages to do the will of God. Church mistakes are acknowledged, and yet we are not to suppose a mistake by the church. Such an approach only verifies an earlier statement which plainly lays the blame on blacks. Quote, we do not envision the reason and purpose behind the priesthood denial. We can only suppose and reason that it is on the basis of the preexistence and of our premortal devotion and faith, unquote. It is this one almost despairing suggestion that resurrects the demeaning theories of black guilt. Here we can see that although they were tactfully ignored in the 1978 announcement, such degrading hypotheses are ubiquitous. Surely it is time to counter this last resort appeal to the pre-existent fence-sitting theory by saying that there are many things we could suppose and reason other than that one unflattering scenario. The pre-existent theory was used by Orson Hyde as early as 1844. He suggested it to explain why the curse of Cain was punishing blacks for Cain's misbehavior if man was not guilty of Adam's transgression. B.H. Roberts and others later related it to the priesthood denial policy. Surely it appealed to these men because of their worldview of whites as superior to blacks. Had they seen blacks as an equal race, their reasoning might have been much more complimentary. The belief that blacks had misbehaved in the preexistence was comfortable to espouse. It was in line with mainstream American thinking. It transferred blame for an embarrassing policy from the church to blacks themselves and seemed innocuous enough on its face. However, let us consider the sentence, I killed two birds with one stone. To human beings, it is a declaration of efficiency. To birds, it is double murder. Likewise, while whites can cheerfully accept the preexistence theory, to the black race, it's downright insulting. Since the whole idea is speculation and neither whites nor blacks can recall the preexistence, it is not a valid excuse. Brother McConkie did not intend to insult anyone with his resurrection of the theory, but it did serve to officially discredit blacks, however much it salvaged church credibility. It is hopeful to note that one can get an official denunciation of this speculation. In a letter to me, the First Presidency stated that there was no scriptural basis for the theory that blacks were fence-sitters in the preexistence, and that the Brethren have never taught or promoted that theory as official church doctrine. Unquote. However, those who would refer to Brother McConkie's talk in the Supplementary Handbook for Church Educators rather than write a letter to the First Presidency of the Church are a potential problem for blacks. In a final attempt to put things into perspective, we are counseled to forget the past. Quote, it doesn't make a particle of difference what anyone ever said about the Negro matter before June 1978. As to any slivers of light or any particles of darkness in the past, we forget them. Unquote. I believe that advice to forget past church writings and sayings about black priesthood denial is excellent. The problem is that it doesn't work, and that what was said in the past makes a great deal of difference. Putting it simply, inquiring minds want to know why the denial used to exist. Because the announcement given by the First Presidency is so restrained, it is not helpful to the curious when the awkward subject comes up, as it inevitably does. It is natural to ask questions, but because the membership of the church is poorly informed or will refer to the supplementary handbook, blacks who approach them with honest questions about the former practice run the risk of being introduced to the Lord's timetable rationale, which leads to a discourse on their gloomy preexistence and a host of proof texts about curses. Several black saints have told me of enduring patiently while nervous white saints explain this depressing story. In this way, the demeaning apologetics of black priesthood denial are perpetuated. Given these popular notions, the recent statement on racial equality is ambiguous. What about this equality? Did it begin just after the 1978 revelation when the alleged curse was lifted? Were the races always equal in spite of the curse, or was there no curse to begin with? It does not broach the issue. Materials which try to reconcile the church's dilemma without using blacks as scapegoats are largely ignored. When they are known, their lack of divine endorsement discredits them. Certainly, they would not be sought out by members who feel they already have the answers. As long as the church will not acknowledge its own difficulties in the matter, members have nowhere to look for explanations but the uncomplimentary speculations of the past. Stubbornly, the old ideas survive. Forgetting the past is commendable, but no one has forgotten, and blacks bear the burden of our remembering. Writing this paper has been difficult. In pointing out the blame that our theology has left on blacks, it was necessary to criticize an apostle's reasoning. This is not generally done in the Mormon Church, particularly by believing members. The tradition of venerating our leaders precedes me, and my fears are a reaction to what Catholic theologian Mary Daly described as the prevailing notion of sin as an offense against those in power. However, in spite of everything, I reject the idea that LDS church leaders really believe this definition of sin, and I am certain that God does not. Like Eve in the garden, I am faced with a lose-lose situation. Should I say nothing and leave the maligned undefended, or should I defend them and go out into that lone and dreary world where I will be accused of not following the brethren? I am counting on Paul Tillich's belief that the critics of profanized religion are justified and can often serve religion. To his credit, Brother McConkie was the first to admit that he and other brethren had spoke with a limited understanding. I merely suggest that this limited understanding included little awareness of racism and oppression and the powerful negative images that spring from them. If he is guilty of such limitations, we are all guilty, and the church must not be the focus of blame for an American and, in a larger sense, a human problem. Because earlier authoritative LDS writings had said that blacks would not get priesthood privileges until after mortality, his main concern was to verify the rightness of the change so that there would be no confusion. This he did unwaveringly and in full faith. Given that he had been taught to believe in the curse theories and in their accompanying mythology, there is reason to expect his point of view. As Tillich explains, it is hard for any church to separate the Christian message from the particular culture within which it is pronounced. In a sense, it is impossible because there is no absolute Christian message. It is always embodied in a particular culture. We must not dismiss Brother McConkie's testimony or his insights, for they are valuable. By comparing the 1978 revelation to Peter's vision of the sheet coming down from heaven with the unclean meat upon it, he showed that mistakes and dilemmas in ethnocentrism are a natural part of true churches. He also showed quite wonderfully that even the most adamant of apostles can humbly eat his words. Certainly, it is not his fault that independent scholarship produced by members of the church is not given official status. Such is the way of organization, avoidable baggage of their authoritative hierarchy systems. As a mother of a black child and friend to several blacks, I have a small window into the world of pain that racial prejudice has caused them. This partial glimpse has convinced me that we must work to eliminate what a recent First Presidency statement called the abhorrent and tragic theory of the superiority of one race or color over another. In the difficulties outlined in this paper, it is clear that the brethren are sincere in their belief that the church is without fault in the matter. I understand the processes that lead them to feel as they do, and I hope to be tolerant of our differences. I am convinced that neither Brother McConkie nor the brethren would ever suggest that saving face at the expense of blacks is consistent with the church's mission. In spite of my anger and pain over this issue, I can still accept their leadership because infallibility is something that I do not demand from them. Nevertheless, I believe that blacks should be officially exonerated. Measures should be taken to identify, expose, and specifically denounce the negative insinuations that are alive and well along the fringes of our theology.
I'm not a naturally loquacious person, and I'm sure you'll come to appreciate that fact before I'm through. I find this topic of discussion stimulating, but let me say from the onset, by topic I mean the curse. Let me say from the onset, as far as I know, that having a black skin is not the result of a curse, so I don't feel there's any curse that I have to escape from. Skin color would appear to be closely related to the climatic conditions under which one's ancestors developed. And I see nothing wrong with that. And since it isn't my purpose to deliver a fifth grade geography or biology lesson, I'll move on and briefly discuss welcoming blacks into the church. When I joined the church, I became a member of the Hyde Park Ward in Chicago, Illinois. Now, Hyde Park covers an area. Our ward area includes 1 million people. Can you imagine 1 million people in a ward area? Now, the Hyde Park Ward isn't what I would call the most representative ward in the church. We had members from many different ethnic groups. For instance, our services were translated into Chinese because we had a few members from Hong Kong who spoke and who still speak very little English. We had many Spanish-speaking members. We also, at that time, only had about 10 black members in the Hyde Park Ward. The dominant group in the ward were the graduate students, and these students made up about 65% of the ward at that time. And so most of the callings that carried the responsibility in the ward were held by the graduate students, the bishop, the counselors, the elders forum president, the relief society presidency, the primary presidency, etc. All were graduate students or students who had graduated and decided to make their home in Chicago. And most of them came from upper middle class white families and had what I called, when my wife and I were alone, a rural Western background. Now, most of the black members in the ward of the 10, about 7 had really a deprived background with very little formal education. And when I became a member, I found that most of the white members didn't consider me to be their peer in any respect at all. And that's because that in Chicago, the church has never really taken off among middle-class blacks. So the majority are those that come from a deprived background. And they seemed to feel that I couldn't understand what they were talking about, so they tended to talk down to me a little bit. I didn't see where it was necessary for me to give my academic credentials to be a member of the ward, so I went along with the program. And the thing that really gave me a problem was this, was that they didn't hold black members to the same standard that they held each other. For instance, we had a guy ordained to the Aaronic priesthood who had pornography all over his house. And I mean, it was well known in the church. And we also had another guy passing the sacrament who was a known philanderer. And I didn't consider that appropriate. I thought it was rather condescending, you know, that they would have these people doing this just because they were black and they wanted to show off black priesthood members. And also, many of the ward members appeared to be keeping black members as pets. Now, let me explain what I mean by pets. By pets, I mean that they would lavish love and attention on them, but it seemed to expect very little in return as far as the normal standards of behavior in the church are concerned. And I was very unhappy about the situation. And I think if I really hadn't had a strong belief in the doctrine of the church, that I would have left at this time. Now, you might ask the question, How should blacks be welcomed in the church? Okay? Well, I feel, and remember, I'm only talking from my own experience and what I would prefer. I don't claim to speak for any group as a whole. But I feel that blacks should be welcomed in the church the same way as anybody else. Okay? And they shouldn't be stereotyped because you have to remember that blacks come from as many different backgrounds as whites do. So many different educational backgrounds, economic, geographical, etc. And I've always wanted us to use a little bit of the discernment that we always talk about in this church. The bishop is able to discern spiritual gifts, etc. Use some of this discernment when we welcome new members, because you're not going to find that every new black member has the same needs. So let's try to discern what they actually need and apply it to that particular person. We should accept people as individuals, and we shouldn't, in summary, we shouldn't assume that a person isn't intelligent because he's black, nor should we assume that he is, but basically we should treat him like everyone else. Thank you very much.
I really don't know why I was asked to moderate this panel discussion on blacks in the church, because I'm not very au courant about the issue in my own personal life. I have very little experience. I was probably asked to do it because I'm excellent at telling people to sit down and shut up, which I didn't need to do, thank goodness, because we were lacking an extra speaker. But I happen to be up here, that puts me in the lucky position of being able to ask the first question, if you don't mind. And I just met the Soils last night, and I would like to ask a couple of questions. Brother Soil mentioned that he has been unhappy at blacks being pets within the church, and this is something that Armand Moss mentioned last evening when he talked about mascotization, I think is what he called it, and that he does not appreciate whites being overly affectionate or compassionate when the blacks are giving in return normal, what he called normal standards of behavior in terms of a reciprocal relationship. And I agree with that completely. However, occasionally I wonder if we might be able to have maybe a little bit more tolerance for a new member of the church, white or black, who is not really aware of what normal standards of behavior in the church might mean, or who may have had so many negative experiences that they may have be a little intolerant of our mistakes, and so that perhaps we might be able to offer them just a little bit more tolerance for the hurt that they may have experienced. And although I view that perhaps as condescending, I have just a little bit of trouble with that, because I hope that it might be viewed as tolerant and loving, which is consistent with the gospel of Jesus Christ. On the other hand, I know that that's a serious problem. We have a friend in a ward in California who has made the same comments, that this sorts of mascotization or petting behavior of blacks is not appreciated or welcome. And I wonder, as this white person who doesn't have that much experience, as Sue does perhaps, in dealing with blacks in the church, simply because of percentages and numbers, and not through any, I mean, it's strictly a demographic problem. I don't live in New Orleans. I don't live in Chicago, where there are a lot of blacks there. What can I do as this white person who does not have that much experience to overcome what is so offensive in my behavior? I'm hearing a lot of treating, of not doing lots, but what can I do to overcome that, me personally? Because I would very much like to, and do not know how, to not offend someone by either being not loving enough or too loving. So where can I find the happy medium? I'd really like to.
You know, I think the problem was that when I joined the church, I considered myself as being pretty much the equal of the people that were there already. So while there was intolerance on their part, there was intolerance on my part too. So it wasn't a matter of the white members of the church adjusting to me or trying to be tolerant or loving of me. It was a matter of us adjusting to each other and me being tolerant and loving of them as well. I feel that black members, many times they're shown too much, well, I don't want to call it masculinization, but if they're patronized too much, they tend not to develop in the church. They tend to think that they are always supposed to receive and not give, and I think giving is what we're all about. But then again, I want to remind everyone I'm only speaking from my own experience. Okay, I don't claim to speak for blacks as a whole. And so like I said, my ward is not representative.
I just wanted to say that it's possible to do a lot of reading on the subject. Racism and oppression go hand in hand, and it's really fascinating reading from the white perspective to see yourself so clearly outlined in what sociologists and anthropologists and historians have written about our behavior with this problem. My interesting experience was to take a class on racism from a professor at Berkeley, and going in feeling pretty smug because I'd adopted a black child and quite sure that I wasn't a racist, and to come out having pretty thick check marks beside my name on several of the things that comprised a racist. To admit my racism was a pretty disappointing experience for me. I found that in talking to one or two very unhappy or members of the church who were black who were feeling unhappy at the time over racism, it seemed to be very welcoming for them when they would say, well, you did this, and it was a little racist to do that, to have me say, yes, I guess that's true, rather than to deny, go into all sorts of overwhelming denials of, well, I didn't mean it, and try to find some way of squeezing out of it. Simply say, yes, that's right. I have a lot to learn. One more, and then we'll get to you.
Just wanted to say that one reason I emphasized, I think, friendship so much was that, you know, two friends aren't an owner and a pet, but they're equals. And I think that, and I think everyone feels this. You know when you're being condescended to. And so, and I sometimes we don't know, though, when we're being condescending. And so try to be aware of that, I think, is very important. And I know I still haven't gotten away from it. And then the other thing is, in what Victor said about people, everyone needs to serve. And so it's important to remember that you can't just give to this new black convert, but you have to ask them to contribute because that's what they want to do. That's what's going to make them grow. And so it just takes, I think, just thinking all the time, like my husband said, and trying to put yourself in the other person's shoe and be aware of what's happening.
Yes.
This has been an extraordinary experience for me. My last church assignment was executive secretary of a branch with 900 Cambodian members. And now I'm principal of three Cambodian seminaries. And I see the same, I'm not hearing descriptions of some of the same kinds of problems that I've been trying to deal with now in a different context. And I had never thought of them as racial problems. The situation where there's an adoption and a pet situation. The families all around in my area have all wanted to adopt the Cambodians. And I thought they were well-meaning about it. And now I can see that can be counterproductive in many ways. The things that Brother Soil said about having lesser expectations has been always a great problem for us because these people come without even knowing Christianity. And my experience of a mission in missionary in the Southern States years ago was, and we had some little enclaves where the gospel had come to some black families, was that they were some of the best Christians that I ever met. Now, where I am right at this moment is that I wish I could take with me and transfer some of the experiences that I've heard about, take them back and use them and benefit from them. It seems to me that some of the experiences our black saints have had would help me as a leader in dealing with Cambodians, Laotians, Chinese, Japanese. And you know, in our state conference, we turned our programs in 8 languages, and everybody walks in to get a pair of earphones because the whites are a minority. All I can say is that we're trying, and for me, this has opened some new vistas. I hope there's some way to tap the experiences, even the negative ones, maybe especially the negative ones, and benefit church church-wide, worldwide, from heavens knows we need them down there in Oakland. We need help. I appreciate the sharing. I don't really have a question, unless it is, how do we expand this thing so that white saints can learn to welcome not only black saints.
Asian saints.
The Asians and the South Americans. Our folks come up, we have saints from Nicaragua. How do we handle those and their problems?
I think the best way is education. Education and education and more education and more love.
It comes from talking about it. Like
exactly.
But how do we get beyond the walls here?
Yes.
I wish I could take all of you with me 3 years ago when I went to the ward on East London where my grandfather and French president back in 1850. The membership there is about half black, of course, and the people are colorblind. It makes no difference, whatever. It just the color of the skin doesn't register. We're not white. White's quite about a value. They're three. They're white, white whites and black whites. You know, pure chocolate, honey, vanilla, as Brother Cheney says. And a lot of grandma. Melanin makes a difference. You know, you pile up the black pigment on the nickel. It makes a difference between the two of us. If we could get away from this uncomfortable awareness, if we could drop this crazy notion of curse, I'm always embarrassed at the ignorance and prejudice of the Mormon people. I don't think any of them have ever read Genesis carefully. If you read it, for a penalty for murdering a brother, he was to be expelled. And never again would be a good farmer. The earth would never yield up his produce. Cain contested his punishment with more than he could bear. You get kicked out of the tribe then while you were alone. You were killed by anybody who came along. And so the Lord gave him a protective mark to keep people from killing him. You can show me where dark skin has got people getting murdered. And then if you read a little further, you read through Cain Mary and his descendants, and it specifies who the descendants of Cain are. They are the workers of metal, the musicians, and the cattle. That is what Genesis actually tells you. So if we get into this foolishness about creed, about curse, then if you will go to your Doctrine and Covenants, which was called our Book of Commandments, which we accepted as coming from God as Scripture, nowhere does it mention black, Negro, anything like that. But 21 places the Lord saw fit to say that the gospel was for all men, every creature, every inhabitant of the earth, and so on. And he says, and this commandment to take the fullness of the gospel is in effect from this moment on, and that was in 1832. We are just a little behind in keeping God's commandment.
That's what this is all about. We're a little behind.
I would like to, first of all, applaud our speakers, and particularly the courage of Mrs. Farnsworth. I know it is not easy to come out and say something, however carefully researched, that may make you look like you're bashing your leaders. And yet I think it's time that we be honest about this issue. My other comment is, as a convert, as someone who is from New York, and also as a woman, I have had my own experiences with being different. And I think we need to really look at that it's time we come of age in the church and look upon ourselves as, first of all, citizens of the world we live in, not as... I hear a lot of people, lived in England. My husband is English. They get kind of tired of feeling that the church is very American. This is such an American church. It's about time that we quit making a separate race of non-members. I mean, the race issue is, to me, the perfect, perfect parable of our unfortunate inabilities as human beings to handle our discomfort zones. I had a baby that died. When my baby died, and we didn't, for some time, find ourselves able to have any children. I had a lot of people who had big discomfort zone in dealing with me. They felt like they couldn't talk about motherhood around me. I was never permitted to talk about my baby, and it was like it was just a non-existent subject that couldn't be brought up. And we have a lot of discomfort zones, and I think the bottom line is, rather than having to have pamphlets saying how to treat women in the church and the wonderful role of a woman and the wonderful role of, or how to treat non-members, and how, if we quit categorizing each other and to just make mistakes but be sincere with each other as human beings, I think we go a long way. And I don't know, and I'd maybe like to ask Brother Soil, but I think he'd be the first one to say, someone who comes with sincerity to make friendship with him and maybe has some social gas and bumbles it a little bit, I think you can sense the sincerity despite mistakes. But it's when we kind of go in with two pamphlets and little Relief Society hat on and you have to try to do it the approved way, and we're so busy trying to do what we think we ought to do that we drop our honesty, we drop our sincerity, I think that's when we offend people. And I think that if we could let ourselves be human enough to make mistakes, but be people and accept others around us as people, it would really help.
Okay, yes.
I'd like to ask the panelists if they were became president of the church tomorrow, what they would do to alleviate the problems of life acceptance and integration of the church.
I'll point that directly at Sonia because I know she'll do real well with that one.
Well, I thought a lot about this, and one of the ideas I thought of was that there'd be an insert in the end sign similar to the one that was put in about the ERA that describes the evidence relating to what I pointed out. And in as nice a way as possible, leaving as much credibility to the church as possible, clear blacks of the implications. And I think that it's easy enough for the general membership of the church to understand that. I know a number of them that do, and they've been able to remain faithful. And I don't want the general authorities to be made foolish. I think the problem is that every time they mention the Lord's timetable as the reason, they just look more and more foolish to me. And it's a difficult and painful experience in my life. But that's one of the practical solutions that I can think of.
I think that probably we should stop looking so much at the past and look toward the future. I'm rather optimistic, despite what any opinion to the contrary I may have given you, in that I believe that as more blacks come into the church, that the problem will alleviate itself, because I think that that blacks and whites will adjust to each other. I think it's only a matter of time now before that happens. I'm not so sure that any further action on the parts of the general authorities is necessary.
Well, I guess like Cindy said, though, education never hurt. And if I were president of the church, which will never happen, I would, I think, try to have blacks more visible in the videotapes that come out. Have blacks not particularly as, just a videotape about blacks, but just have blacks visible as your basic ward member interacting with your other basic ward members. And I think I probably would put out a letter saying that for all investigators that got baptized, they ought to get home teachers and visiting teachers at the baptism. I think that really was, I'm surprised no one's thought of it yet. It just seems so logical and sensible, because it doesn't matter if you're black, white, or purple, if you've got four friends there.
I think it has been thought of quite a bit, tried to be instituted repeatedly. Unfortunately,
we're all human.
What works in theory doesn't necessarily translate into reality as well as we'd like it to. Yes, in back.
Thank you. I responded very warmly to Sonia Marshworth's call that we heard last night also for a repudiation of the doctrinal folklore associated with the policy of restriction on the priesthood. And I would just like to make one comment concerning one of the bases that has or was set forth as justification for that restriction, which is in Abraham 1:26-27. And I think that a careful reading of the text will show that the Pharaoh, who was cursed as to the priesthood, was the one who received Abraham into his court. And we have a picture of that Pharaoh in facsimile number 3, and he's white.
Thank you. So we see them in administrative levels.
The ones that are nation presidents, the state presidents, they're doing some wonderful work.
The more we can get to the view about the mission.
Yes.
I'd kind of like to direct this just to Sister Hattie Soyle. I think I remember her mentioning something about one of the big problems she saw, at least in the Hyde Park Ward, with the blacks, and especially some of the black youth, something to do with their falling away and her ward. So I'm wondering if you have a comment on that.
In our ward, we have a lot of young black who cannot read the scriptures, period. We have started a literacy program, which we find is very important for our black members, and to at least let them read the Book of Mormon for themselves. Our retention rate of black youth, I mean, because they feel that our ward is a universal ward, and the people are so educated that they cannot fit in because they cannot read. So we figured that if we can teach them or have someone there, tutors, we're trying to get tutors from the Salt Lake area as missionaries to help us in our quest to teach our young black members to read and to read scriptures for themselves.
Are you getting the kind of help you need now?
Now we are. We had to take the Boiled Lake Education to court, but we have gotten the help we need now from a lot of people in the state. They have come forward to aid us in this.
I think also that what we're talking about here is related to race, but is also an educational problem, a class problem. When we're talking about literacy, obviously we may have many whites who could join the church and not be able to read and have the same sorts of problems. Although it may show up a little bit more in black Chicago, it may show up a little bit more in white or sections of Mississippi. You know, it's maybe not necessarily as race-related as it is educational level and class.
Well, since we are growing so rapidly, we're 43% black in our ward, so we are growing fast. And this is a very, very large problem in our area, and we are baptizing the youth very, very fast. So we need to have this. This is very, very important that we must have.
Okay. Yes?
You have many graduate students, you say, University of Chicago people.
Right.
Why can't they get into your literacy problem? To help. Why can't your university people work with your literacy needs rather than sending out Salt Lake City for help?
What Hattie failed to say about that is that as far as tutoring is concerned, we're probably all right as far as with what we have on the ward. But where we need experienced welfare and education missionaries. We thought like retired couples who might be interested in serving missions, that type of thing. Somebody who's mature and committed. You see, our students come and go in the ward. During the summer, most of them come back to Utah or Idaho. We want someone who's going to be there and who's going to be committed to our literacy program and also One thing we didn't talk about was the welfare program, too. We need people to actually teach that, because that's a big problem in Chicago.
One more. Thank you.
Just a comment in passing. I believe the church has come a long way in recognizing the need to internationalize the church. I've had the opportunity of serving in the past in the church curriculum division, writing manuals, and I know that we have been instructed innumerable times to get the Utah principles out of the manual, to get the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant out of the manual. But it's a slow, long process. Not very long ago, with all that's happened in the world, I had occasion it was last Christmas time, to be in the basement of the visitor center on Temple Square. They have a wonderful mural of going into all the world. And they've got someone in a Scotch costume and a Swedish costume and a Finnish costume. There isn't a black face in the mural. And this is 1987. I don't think that was overt racism, but surely it was an insensitivity to the fact that huge masses of humanity have been left out. I don't have to go back that far. Those of you who watched the 24th of July parade would have seen that same thing, go ye into all the world. And I'm glad we've come this far. There was a Cambodian on the float, and there were some Scandinavians and possibly Chinese, but again, no black.
Yes.
I believe I'm probably the only fossil here. I've read much of the literature, attempted to find the original sources of the statements and the background that the statements that the church has made and the individual people have made with regard to the black question, also the scriptures, of course. I probably didn't read them as carefully as others. We may have missed things. It's very difficult for me to sit here and say they were wrong, absolutely wrong in the past. We are right, they're wrong. And it may be true, it could be true. There's such certitude. So, I feel that the Spirit has testified to people who now, in almost as a testimony meeting, that restrictions on the priesthood were in the past the wrong. And of course, the time frame situation is an inaccurate portrayal of how things were, and that should all be scuttled. I'm not there yet. Maybe it's me, but I'm a little bit uncomfortable with such strong testimony being borne here. And I would like to say, I just finished reading Brigham Young's speeches to the territorial legislature on the black question. I definitely did not agree with everything I read there. I don't agree with everything I hear here. I'm definitely in the middle.
Perhaps we'd like to conclude this with, because I get the privilege, because I happen to be at the microphone, I'd like to maybe tell you how I reconcile that middle ground myself. I remember that the church was leaving Missouri in the 1830s and 40s. That was an extremely difficult time politically, racially in the United States. Those problems are well known to us. Perhaps Brigham Young made this policy decision at that time based on those difficulties because the church needed to survive and that he obviously had a worldview that is different from mine or from the Soils or from a number of people now, but he made a policy decision that was perhaps appropriate at the moment in Missouri and Illinois in the 1830s and 40s. But we kind of outgrew it. We let it go on perhaps a little bit longer than it needed to. and that we finally saw that the policy needed changing. Unfortunately, that policy over the years took on quasi-doctrinal tones that we had a difficult time discerning. But that as America moved forward and no longer had those serious racial political problems, that policy was no longer needful. And although it may have been perhaps a wise decision when it was made, it became extremely unwise as time progressed. And we let it go on a little bit longer than, or maybe perhaps a lot longer than it should have, which was a mistake that we corrected. And at this point, all we can do is say, hey, we corrected it, let's move forward and continue to correct whatever wrongs there may yet be. I'd like to thank you for coming and enjoy the rest of the symposium.